Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Jeremiah chapter 43, which I will entitle Jeremiah Taken to Egypt. We are now in that stage of Israel's history, Judah's history, post-destruction of Jerusalem in 586 by the Babylonians. The Babylonians appointed Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, as the governor of Judah, and Gedaliah took up his residence at Mizpah, which was going to be the capital city of the province of Judah. Unfortunately, one of his commanders, a man named Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, decided that he, upon being bribed by the king of Ammon, wanted to take over the kingdom. He tried. He killed Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, killed a bunch of people, threw their bodies in a cistern, and headed out from Mizpah, a few miles to the southwest, to Gibeon. At Gibeon, all of Ishmael, son of Nethaniah's captives, which is basically the harem and court officials in charge of the harem of the late king Zedekiah. I say late king, he'd been carried off to Babylon, the last king of Judah. So the remnants of his household were taken down to Gibeon by Ishmael, son of Nethaniah. But when those captives deserted Ishmael, Ishmael headed out to Ammon, leaving the harem, the remnant of the pitiful people of Judah, in charge of Jonathan, son of Korea, who was another one of Gedaliah's military commanders. Yohanan went southeast from Gibeon to a place called Geruth-Kimham, which was near Bethlehem. Now at Geruth-Kimham, Jeremiah was asked by Jonathan, son of Korea, the leader, to prophesy over them. What should they do? Where should they go? Jeremiah said, you need to stay here, submit to the Babylonians, and don't go to Egypt. And so that's where we take up our story here, Jeremiah 43, verses 1 through 5. When Jeremiah finished telling the people all the words of the Lord their God, everything the Lord had sent him to tell them, Azariah, son of Hoshea, and Yohanan, son of Korea, and all the arrogant men said to Jeremiah, you are lying. The Lord our God has not sent you to say you must not go to Egypt to settle there. But Baruch, son of Neriah, is inciting you against us to hand us over to the Babylonians, so they may kill us or carry us into exile to Babylon. So Yohanan, son of Korea, and all the army officers and all the people disobeyed the Lord's command to stay in the land of Judah. Instead, Yohanan, son of Korea, and all the army officers led away all the remnant of Judah who had come back to live in the land of Judah from all the nations where they had been scattered. Now, Yohanan, son of Korea, was the leader. He was the one that said, you're lying. He had a compadre named Azariah, son of Hoshea, who also said that Jeremiah was lying. Now, this Azariah has not showed up before. Perhaps he was the same as Jezaniah, who was mentioned in Jeremiah 42:1 as one of the leaders. Doesn't matter. The point is that these are idiots saying that Jeremiah is lying. That was a pretty arrogant response when you consider that these leaders had asked for the word from Jeremiah themselves. We read in Jeremiah 42, verses 1 through 3. Then all the commanders of the armies, along with Yohanan, son of Korea, Jezaniah, son of Hoshea, and all the people from the least to the greatest, approached Jeremiah the prophet and said, may our petition come before you. Pray to the Lord your God on our behalf, on behalf of this entire remnant, for a few of us remain out of the many, as you can see with your own eyes, that the Lord your God may tell us the way we should walk and the thing we should do. So they ask for the prophecy, he gives it to them, and then they accuse him of lying. Yes, sir, the land of Judah had some real first-class leaders. And what made it worse is that these leaders had vowed to obey whatever word that Jeremiah gave them. We read in Jeremiah 42, verses 5 through 6, and they said to Jeremiah, as for every word the Lord your God sends you to tell us, if we don't act accordingly, may the Lord be a true and faithful witness against us. Whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, we will obey the voice of the Lord our God to whom we are sending you, so that it may go well with us. We will certainly obey the voice of the Lord our God. Famous last words. Now they accuse him of lying. Now, the reason they give for thinking that Jeremiah was lying is stupid. Verse 3, but Baruch, son of Neriah, is inciting you against us. That's what they claim. Baruch, of course, is Jeremiah's loyal and faithful secretary. Well, why was the charge that Baruch was the one who had got Jeremiah to say this bad prophecy? Well, first of all, Jeremiah was older than Baruch. It's not likely that an older man would be prevailed upon by a younger person. And not only that, it is unlikely that a man would be prevailed upon by his secretary. I mean, it was his employee. So the employee tells the boss what to do. Not only that, there's no reason that Baruch should have any interest to want the rump of Judah to stay in Babylon, unless you say that personally he might have wanted to stay in Judah and not go to Egypt. That's possible, but unlikely. Another reason it was stupid for Jonathan, son of Kareah, and Azariah, son of Hoshea, to accuse Jeremiah of lying and to accuse Baruch of instigating Jeremiah to lie is that both Baruch and Jeremiah were too good of men to declare a falsehood in the name of the Lord. They were good men. This remnant of Judah, Jonathan the son of Kareah and Azariah, surely knew Jeremiah's history. Of course they knew Jeremiah's history. He's a famous man in Judah. What had Jeremiah ever done to make the remnant think he wanted to do them in? These people are panicked. They're scared of the Babylonians. They're scared that the Babylonians are going to accuse them of being involved in the revolt of Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, despite the fact that Jonathan of Kareah had fought Ishmael of Nethaniah. Apparently, Jonathan, son of Kareah, thought that the Babylonians would not have understood that revolt. They might have thought that Jonathan was first involved in it and then had turned on Ishmael. But at any rate, they were scared of the Babylonians and didn't want to stay. But God had given them a word, but they weren't interested in what God had to say. They wanted Jeremiah to prophesy something just to give them cover, to make them look good in the eyes of God and the prophet. They were never planning on listening to Jeremiah. So in verse 4, Johanan, the officers, the people, they disobeyed God's command to stay in the land of Judah. Verse 5, instead, Johanan, son of Kareah, and all the army officers led away all the remnant of Judah, who had come back to live in the land of Judah from all the nations where they had been scattered. Now notice now that there's more than the harem, some leftover army people, officials of Zedekiah's reign, but also just ordinary people who had been scattered from all the nations, which would mean the surrounding nations of Israel. They were scattered because of the Babylonian invasion. The Babylonians came and they ran. They could have gone to countries like Edom to the south, Moab to the southeast, Ammon to the east, Aram to the north, Philistia to the west. But now that the Babylonians had come, they had all come back to Judah and put themselves under the jurisdiction of Jonathan, son of Kareah, or before Gedaliah, before he was murdered. So we go now to Jeremiah 43, verses 6 through 10. They also led away, that is, Jonathan, son of Kareah, and Azariah, and all the other officers, led away all the men, women, and children, and the king's daughters, whom Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, had left with Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and Jeremiah, the prophet, and Baruch, son of Neriah. So they entered Egypt in disobedience to the Lord and went as far as Tapanhes. In Tapanhes, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. While the Jews are watching, take some large stones with you and bury them in clay in the brick pavement at the entrance to Pharaoh's palace in Tapanhes. Then say to them, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. I will send for my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and I will set his throne over these stones I have buried there. He will spread his royal canopy above them. So in verse 6, Jonathan is leading the rump of Judah back to Egypt. That rump included all the men. Well, who were the men that were included? Probably the surviving court officials from Zedekiah's reign, probably the eunuchs who were taking care of the harem. It was probably most of the officials who had survived. The men might have included a few surviving soldiers who had survived Ishmael's assassination of Gedaliah at Mizpah. And then the women and children, that was probably Zedekiah's harem. As Wikipedia says, a harem would include prepubescent males, little kids, little boys. So women and children would be women and boys and girls. And the king's daughters, they would be in the harem too. This is referring, of course, probably to the king's unmarried daughters who were in the harem, whom Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, had left with Gedaliah. Now Nebuzaradan, of course, was Nebuchadnezzar's chief commander, in charge of a lot of operations during the siege, and he had left all these survivors with Gedaliah, whom Nebuchadnezzar had appointed as governor of Judah. Now also with this group of people who were being carried to Egypt included Jeremiah and Baruch, son of Neriah. Baruch was Jeremiah's secretary. Verse 7, they entered Egypt in disobedience to the Lord and went as far as Tapanhes. Now Tapanhes, if you look at the map, is right in the middle of the present-day course of the Suez Canal. As you come down from the Mediterranean Sea, head toward the Bitter Lakes, which then goes into the Gulf of Suez. It's at the western end of the desert of Shur, S-H-U-R, right there at the eastern end of the Goshen Desert, the land of Goshen. And so while they're in Tapanhes, Jeremiah has a word. In verse 9, while the Jews are watching, take some large stones with you and bury them in clay in the brick pavement at the entrance to Pharaoh's palace in Tapanhes. Prophets, of course, love to use props for their prophecies. These are prop prophecies so that people will remember what they said. And Jeremiah is to do something while the Jews are watching, so they will remember. Jeremiah was to take some large stones and bury those stones. Now, the Hebrew here is obscure. Bury them in clay in the brick pavement. Well, that's what the NIV translation says, brick pavement. Looking at various other translations, we see the kin, the mortar, the brickwork, the courtyard, the terrace, as well as the pavement. So we see the word is not easily translated. So let's look at some options as to what this pavement might be. Option number one, a dais. As Ellicott says, a structure of brick, a dais, or raised pavement, like the Gabbatha or pavement on which Pilate sat. And this dais was in front of the entrance of the palace on which the king naturally placed his throne when he sat in judgment or received petitions. Option number two, it means pavement, like the NIV has. Pulpit and Barnes agree with that. Barnes says it's possibly a pavement. The pulpit commentary says it is pavement. Colin Delitzsch thinks it's a brick kin. Now, a lot of the translations, especially the older ones, do have it as a kin, a place where you cook bricks. But there are some factors militating against that. As Poole says, the Egyptians dried their bricks in the sun, not in kins. And Ellicott says there's something incongruous about putting a brick kin at the entrance to a royal palace. But you can argue against that. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, Pharaoh's house could have been being repaired, and there was a brick kin there to take care of the repairs. But I would argue against that. The repairs are not permanent. They're going to move the brick kin, are they not? And so it wouldn't be around at the time that the prophecy was to be fulfilled. Matthew Poole says it could be that the entranceway was so vast that the kin would be at a distance, and so it wouldn't be stupid to have a kin in front of a king's doorway. It could be that Egyptian customs might be different than ours. After all, in Hebrew history, great princes' children tended sheep like Jacob's sons and Laban's daughters, so why might not it be true that a pharaoh would be perfectly happy with a kin at his doorstep? Well, I find, on balance, the argument that it's a brick kin to not sway me at all. We're going to take it as pavement. A dais might be all right because that's a raised portion of the pavement, but let's just take it as pavement. I think that's the easiest thing to do. Now, the large stones that Jeremiah had in his hands were to be buried in clay. Now, there's much clay in Egypt due to the flooding of the Nile, but buried in clay doesn't make a lot of sense. Ellicott and Pulpit say that it's really mortar or cement, not clay. Of course, the mortar or cement could have been made out of clay, but you mix water with it, make it hard. In fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible translation of verse 9 backs that view of Ellicott and the pulpit commentary up. Verse 9 in the Holman Christian Study Bible says, pick up some large stones and set them in the mortar of the brick pavement. And that's what we're going to go with, the mortar of the brick pavement that is at the opening of Pharaoh's palace at Tapanhes. The Cambridge commentary says it should not even be translated as clay, but rather secretly in the brickwork. All right, in the midst of all of that fuzziness, we're going to take it that Jeremiah is going to take these large stones, he's going to bury them in mortar, the mortar that keeps the bricks and the pavement together. And we'll assume that the mortar is pretty thick. Now, in verse 9, when it says the stones will be buried, Barnes says that what that means is that the stones would be plastered over with another layer of mortar so that the pavement would not be scarred up. Now, we need to ask ourselves a question. Why would Jeremiah be allowed to do this? This is in front of the Pharaoh's palace. Well, the pulpit commentator says that he was allowed to do that because he was an acknowledged prophet of God. And thinking on that, I think that the Judean remnant wouldn't bother him because, after all, he is a prophet of God. How about the Egyptians? Well, I don't think they would bother him either. They would probably be fascinated by the strange sight of this old man. I assume Jeremiah's pretty old by now. He's down there with a trowel mortaring up some stones, which does seem pretty strange. But he doesn't look dangerous. He's not doing anything that would harm anybody, so they probably just let him do it. Now, I haven't mentioned what the purpose of these stones were, so we read that in verse 10. Jeremiah is to say to the people of Judah, "This is what God says, Nebuchadnezzar's coming. I will set Nebuchadnezzar's throne over these stones I have buried here. He will spread his royal canopy above them." So that was just a nice prophetic way of saying the Babylonians are going to wipe out the Egyptians. And that's why you shouldn't have come down here, because they're not going to be happy with you when they come down here. Now notice that God sovereignly tells Nebuchadnezzar what to do. "I will send for my servant Nebuchadnezzar," God says. But Nebuchadnezzar came of his own free will, of course. He didn't realize that God's sovereignty is what put him down there. This is another classic example of how human beings' free will works in perfect complementary harmony with the sovereign will of God. Just like God predestined before the foundation of the world that the Jewish leaders would use their free will to crucify Christ, as we read in the book of Acts. We go now to Jeremiah 43, verses 11 through 13, and we will finish this chapter. Jeremiah is still quoting Yahweh, so Yahweh is speaking here. "He," that's Nebuchadnezzar, "will come and attack Egypt, bringing death to those destined for death, captivity to those destined for captivity, and the sword to those destined for the sword. He will set fire to the temples of the gods of Egypt. He will burn their temples and take their gods captive. As a shepherd wraps his garment around him, so will he wrap Egypt around himself and depart from there unscathed. There in the temple of the sun in Egypt, he will demolish the sacred pillars and will burn down the temples of the gods of Egypt." So Nebuchadnezzar is going to do to Egypt what Nebuchadnezzar did to Judah. In verse 11, Nebuchadnezzar is going to bring death to those destined for death. In other words, in God's sovereign will, they're not getting out of it. They're going to die. "Captivity to those destined for captivity." Some will die, some will be carried into captivity back to Babylon. "And the sword to those destined for the sword." I assume those are the same people that were destined for death. Now that sounds an awful lot like Revelation 13:10, which says, "If anyone is destined for captivity, into captivity he goes. If anyone is to be killed with a sword he will be killed." The pulpit commentary says that John, the author of Revelation, is quoting Jeremiah here, Jeremiah 43, verse 11, and I think that's exactly what he's doing. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, after firing the temples of the gods of Egypt, burning the temples down and so forth, taking their gods captive, that's what they would do back then. They would get idols and put them on camels or whatever and take them back to their capital city to show that they were in charge now. And they would put those idols in their temples, in the victor's temple. "As a shepherd wraps his garment around him," this is talking about Nebuchadnezzar, a shepherd will wrap his garment around him and get up. It's very easy to do that. You put your coat on, you walk. Nebuchadnezzar is going to come down to Egypt, look around, put his coat on, and take off. Putting his coat on, of course, after he destroyed their temples. Verse 13, "There in the temple of the sun in Egypt, he will demolish the sacred pillars before he is left there unscathed, easily walking away from all the damage he's going to do. There in the temple of the sun in Egypt, Nebuchadnezzar will demolish the sacred pillars." Now, the temple of the sun is the NIV translation. We have a translation issue here. Many of the translations have Beth Shemesh, which means temple of the sun. KJV, Holman Christian Study Bible Margin, the ASV, the Bible in Basic English, the Darby translation of God's Word. Most of them have Beth Shemesh. The Darby marginal note has Temple of the Sun. The NIV here has Temple of the Sun. Kyle and Delitz say that this Temple of the Sun was the famous Temple of the Sun at Heliopolis. Some translations say it's not the temple at Heliopolis, but it's actually Heliopolis itself, the whole city. Because Beth Shemesh, as the Darby note says, means house or temple of the sun. Hence called by the Greeks Heliopolis, which means city of the sun. The Egyptian name is On. Now, this city, which is right where the Nile River branches off into those other smaller branches that run into the Mediterranean, looks like a fan, where present-day Cairo is. In fact, Heliopolis is now a suburb of Cairo with the same name. It was famous for sun worship. It had a big temple to the sun there, as Kyle and Dillard say. Isaiah 19:18 foretells the destruction of Heliopolis. Isaiah 19:18, on that day, five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan and swear loyalty to the Lord of hosts. One of the cities will be called the City of the Sun. Now that City of the Sun was formerly called On. Heliopolis was the Greek name. On was the Egyptian name. We read in Genesis 41:45, Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah and gave him a wife, Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest at On. That's the Egyptian name. The Young's Literal Translation translates it as House of the Sun, which is the same thing as Temple of the Sun. So it's either the temple at Heliopolis or it was the whole city that's going to be destroyed. I don't think it makes much difference to worry about which it is, because if you destroy the temple, you're going to destroy the city too. That goes as par for the course. Those two destructions would go hand in hand. Now the sacred pillars will be demolished. Those are referring to the famous obelisk of Egypt, as Barnes says. Colin Dellett says this, the obelisk of the most famous temple of the Egyptian sun god are well known as the most splendid representatives of the glory of the Egyptian idolatry. The destruction of these monuments indicates the ruin of all the sanctuaries of the ancient kingdom of the pharaohs. One of those obelisks, according to one of my commentators, ended up in Rome because Caesar Augustus stole it after conquering Cleopatra. But at any rate, these famous sacred pillars, they had religious significance. They had something to do with the idol worship. They will be demolished. And also the temples will be burnt down, as verse 13 tells us. So now the question is when did Nebuchadnezzar do this to On? When did Nebuchadnezzar do this to Heliopolis, Beth Shemesh, the house of the sun, or to the temple that's in Heliopolis? Well, apparently it's a little bit fuzzy as to when that happened. At least it is to me. So I'm going to give you some quotations that give suggestions as to when Pharaoh was beaten, when the Egyptians were beaten by Nebuchadnezzar. Ellicott says the fulfillment is related by Josephus in Josephus's book Antiquities, section 9, section 10, subsection 9, subsection 7. Colin Delitzsch says that this fulfillment of the destruction of Heliopolis is described by Jeremiah in the next chapter, chapter 44, verse 30, which reads this way. This is what the Lord says. I'm about to hand over Pharaoh Hophra, Egypt's king, to his enemies, to those who want to take his life, just as I handed over Judah's king Zedekiah to Babylon's king Nebuchadnezzar, who was his enemy, the one who wanted to take his life. So Nebuchadnezzar came down there and wiped out Egypt. Now, John Gill says this, of his expedition into Egypt, Nebuchadnezzar's expedition into Egypt, whereby this prophecy was fulfilled, not only Josephus makes mention, but some heathen writers gave plain hints of it. The Jewish historian, that's Josephus, says that Nebuchadnezzar, 5 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, led his army into Cold Syria, that's the area of Lebanon between the two mountain ranges there, the Lebanon Range and the Anti-Lebanon Range. So Nebuchadnezzar's army went there and took it, and then they made war with Ammonites and Moabites, that's to the east of the Dead Sea, and having subdued these nations, made a push into Egypt in order to destroy that and slay the king of it. That's Josephus says that. And Berosus says, another ancient historian, that Nebuchadnezzar, having settled his affairs in Egypt and other countries, and having committed to his friends the captives of the Jews, Phoenicians, Syrians, and the nations about Egypt, went to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar settled his affairs in Egypt, says Berosus. And Megasthenes relates that Nebuchadnezzar conquered the greatest part of Libya or Africa and Iberia, that's Spain. So that's northern Africa, that would include Egypt. Or, as it is elsewhere expressed, he led his army into Libya and Iberia, and having subdued these, carried colonies of them to the right of Pontus, back up in present-day Turkey, south of the Black Sea. So we will assume that this prophecy of Jeremiah has been fulfilled. And again, I think that the reason that God gave the prophecy through Jeremiah was to tell the people, you stay down here and go to Egypt and look to them for your protection. It's not going to do you any good. The Babylonians are going to get you anyway, so you need to go back up to Judah and submit. They gave you the chance to live peacefully in Judah if you would just obey them, and you haven't done it. And so now you're going to be subject to disaster. You are going to be destined for death, destined for captivity, and destined for the sword, because you will be there as the Egyptians are getting whacked. You're going to get whacked too. So ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Jeremiah 43, and we are prepared to go to Jeremiah 44, which I will entitle Judgment for Idolatry. I hope you stay tuned for that discussion in our next chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.